That's our prayer this morning, that you would take our lives and let it be yours. The one thing we have to offer, the most valuable thing we have to put on your altar is our lives, and we dedicate them to you. God, we say that in words. I pray that you would show us how to do that indeed. In Jesus' name, amen. So we just turned the calendar over. It's January, so we flipped the calendar from 2015 to 2016, and it feels like a very monumental, momentous thing, right? Really, it's a made-up thing. Calendar, we came up with a calendar ourselves. It's not a God-ordained thing. It's not like God blessed us with a calendar. We developed the calendar, and really, the one day, December 31st, is really just one day. January 1st is really just another day. But for us, it feels like a bigger day, and it's kind of valuable because it gives us a time. It kind of triggers in us a moment to pause and take inventory of our life, because it feels like the step, kind of like a birthday does in the same way. As we shift the calendar over, it moves us to kind of look at our lives and see what we've been doing and see the trajectory we're on, the where we're heading. And so that's a valuable thing. So we want to pause and do that because I think we don't do it often enough. Andy Stanley, he's a famous pastor, he had a good quote, and I want to read it to you, and I think it's so true. This is what he said: everybody ends up somewhere in life. Few end up somewhere on purpose. Everybody ends up somewhere in life, but few really end up somewhere on purpose. Typically, our lives, it's just kind of going through step by step, following impulses, and we just kind of get moved around by whatever seems best at the moment. And at the end of our lives, you'll be somewhere, but very few get to be somewhere on purpose. And that's why, so talking about living life on purpose, living life with intentionality. We're going to start a new series beginning today, a four-week series called On Purpose. We're going to talk about that very thing, about living our lives with a purpose, intentionally, and to bring about a purpose in our from our lives. And typically, around New Year's, we talk about living with purpose. And we call it with making resolutions, right? I'm going to make this change. I'm going to live with intentionality. I'm going to have purpose in my life, and I'm going to change this thing. The problem is, typically, those are very self-centered purposes, right? We say, I am going to lose weight in 2016. I'm going to change my life. I'm going to eat better. I'm going to cut out soda. I'm going to stop with the whatever, and I'm going to lose weight. And so that's my purpose for this year. Or I'm going to go back to school so I get more education, so I can get a better job. I'm going to get out of debt. I'm going to pay off my bills. I'm going to show diligence to them. I'm going to cut that out. I'm going to do whatever it is, something about, usually something about me and self-improvement. And usually that's our purpose that we come up with for the new year. We think, hey, I want to live to improve myself. Well, this morning, I want to challenge you to think of even greater than that. I mean, those are all good things. I'm not bagging on that stuff. It's all fine. But I want to challenge you to think of, get your eyes off of just that and think of something even greater, something bigger. And have your purpose not just be about you, but be about the world outside of you. Because I believe God has a purpose for every one of us, that you were created and designed for a specific purpose, that God, as our creator, knit you together and made you the perfect tool based on your attributes and your experiences and your education and your passions and all those things. He put you, individually you, together for a purpose. He's got a specific plan for you and a purpose for you. And I firmly believe that where we find value, where we find joy, where we find fulfillment, the best place for us to be is accomplishing God's purpose for us. That's the best place you can be, is living a life, accomplishing the purpose God has for you. And I can tell you that his purpose for you is bigger than you. So if we keep our purpose on just on me and what's best for me and self-improvement for me, you're going to miss out on God's purpose for you and what's really best for you. Because God's plan is going to be bigger than just you. He's going to have more in store for you than just you. So as we begin this series today, this series we're going to be looking at as we talk about living on purpose. So it's not just about living our own purpose, but living God's purpose for us. Living out God's purpose, discovering God's purpose and living that out in our lives. So as we take these 4 weeks to talk about this, we're going to be looking at Old Testament character, Nehemiah. So together we're going to be looking at Nehemiah, because Nehemiah was a guy who lived for a purpose. There was one thing that motivated him, that drove him, that directed his life, and this was accomplishing God's purpose for him. And so we're going to see that. Today we're going to start with the beginning in Nehemiah chapter 1 as we look at Nehemiah, and we're talking about pursuing God's purpose for us. As we're going to see where Nehemiah discovers God's purpose for him and what that drove, what that looked like for him to pursue out God's purpose. So if you got Bibles, go ahead and open them up to Nehemiah chapter 1. And how you can find Nehemiah, you can look at the table of contents, but if you want to make it look like you don't need to look in the table of contents, what you could do is you just open the Bible in the middle. As long as you just open about the middle, you're going to be in Psalm, right? If you just open in the middle, you'll be in Psalms, and then turn left about three books, and you'll get to Nehemiah. So Nehemiah and the paperback Bibles is on page number 333. 333 is the book of Nehemiah. As you turn in there, let me give you some context of what's going on. It's Old Testament, so we got to know where in history, what's going on in the book of Nehemiah. This is, Nehemiah takes place in 446 B.C. And this is about 150 years after the Israelites have been captured by the Babylonians. So the Israelites during this time period, they are not free. They're not their own people. They are ruled by another nation. So about 150 years before this, Babylonians came in, wiped them out. They sacked Jerusalem. They destroyed the temple. They reduced everything to rubble, and they took everybody off to captivity. So about 150 years ago, they've been taken away to be slaves in Babylonia. That was about 150 years ago. After about 70 years of being in captivity, the Persians came in, took over, defeated the Babylonians, and now the Persians are in charge. There's new ownership. Okay, so now they're still slaves. They're still not free. But now the Persians are in control. So same deal. But when the Persians came into control, they said, "Wait, who are you people, Israelites? Where are you from, Jerusalem? Yeah, you can go back there. That's cool." And so they let King Cyrus issued a decree that all the Israelites, whoever wanted to, can go back to the Holy Land, or they can go back to Jerusalem. They can rebuild and do whatever. That's fine. Now, you're not your own people. You belong to us. This is a Persian Empire. You're part of it. You pay us taxes. We rule over you. But if you want to go back to Jerusalem, you can. So that had happened about 80 years before we find the book of Nehemiah. So after about 80 years of people going back to Jerusalem and they're rebuilding and all that is where we find our character Nehemiah and where we begin in the book of Nehemiah. Now Nehemiah, we pick up with him, he's not in Jerusalem, back rebuilding and all that. We find Nehemiah in the Persian capital. He's living in the household of King Artaxerxes, is the king at the time, and Nehemiah is in his household. Artaxerxes, he is the son of King Xerxes. We know Xerxes from the book of Esther. If you're familiar with the book of Esther, that's when Xerxes the king, Esther was his wife. This evil dude, Haman, came up with a plan to have all the Israelites killed. God moved in Esther's heart for her to go challenge the king on this and say, hey, why, to vouch for the Israelites, to stand up for them. And God used her to save the Israelite people. That happened about 30 years before the book of Nehemiah. And actually, Esther is a stepmother to Artaxerxes. So she's still on the scene. So this is about the same time period of that. So it's the next generation. Esther's now the stepmother. Artaxerxes the king. And that's where we pick up Nehemiah. So that's what's going on. All right, that's our scene. That's what's happening. Nehemiah, who he is the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And what the cupbearer does is he's overlooking all of Artaxerxes' food and drink to make sure it's not poisoned. And so this was an important position. It was kind of a position of power. He was in Artaxerxes' inner circle. He was, they talked a lot. He was part of his council. It wasn't just like, hey, I might die if I eat this, so hey, you, Nehemiah, come taste this, and I'm going to watch and see if you keel over and die. It wasn't just like that, so it was not like he was, disposable. But instead, he oversaw the king's safety. So he oversaw the kitchens and the food as it was brought to him, and to make sure there was no poison in his food. So that was his role. So he had the king's ear. It was kind of a significant position. It was kind of posh. He lived in the palace. He was part of his council, and he could speak to the king in a different way than a lot of people because he was with him all the time. Like, he was always around him because, you know, he had to oversee what he ate and all those sort of things. Okay, so that is Nehemiah. That's our scene. That's what's going on. That's what's going on in history with the Israelites, with Nehemiah, with the Persian Empire, all that. Okay, let's read together Nehemiah chapter 1. All right. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 12th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some of my with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. So he's asking, what happens? What's going on over Jerusalem? It's been 80 years. How are things going over there? Verse 3. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. Verse 4. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, here's his prayer, verse 5, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Notice how he starts with who God is, that picture of God, who God really is. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Verse 8. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizons, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Verse 10. They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. All right, so here we have Nehemiah, and Nehemiah discovers his purpose, discovers his God-given purpose. And that is to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. To rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. How did he know that this was his purpose? How did he know that this was important, that God had put it on his heart? Because when he heard about it, he got moved to action. He heard about the need, and it moved him to action. Our central truth, what we're going to talk about this morning, is when we're faced with God's purpose for us, this is often the result. So our central truth is this. To discover God's purpose for you, ask yourself a question. To discover God's purpose for you, ask, what breaks your heart? What breaks your heart? See, with Nehemiah, when they heard that the walls were destroyed and the gates were down, and he heard about the condition of Jerusalem. Verse 4, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted before the God of heaven. So here we have Nehemiah. He was faced with this. He heard about it, and it broke his heart. It mattered to him. It grabbed him. This became significant. It came more than just a story of something going on in a far-off place. It mattered. Now think about this. He had never been there. It's not like, oh, Jerusalem in all its glory. I remember the days. No, 150 years. It had been 150 years since it had been ransacked. And so he'd never seen it. He'd never been there. People had gone off. They traveled away. But he's never seen it. Didn't have any relationship beyond just those are my people. And this is where we're supposed to be from. And it's in disarray. And it broke his heart. You may think, oh, what's the big deal? A wall got broken down. What's the big deal about a wall? Well, a wall was kind of a big deal back then. For one, obviously security was an issue. So any marauders and raiders and criminals, thieves can just come in and steal. So a wall is important in that sense. But two, there was kind of an identity issue with having a wall. Because that's what kept them distinct. It made them who they were. Like, who's inside the wall and who's outside the wall. And God was very specific about, hey, I want you to be my people and not like commingling with all these others. I want you to remain pure and be my people. And when they didn't have a wall, they were scattered all over the place. And so because there was no safety there, there was no security, and they were just kind of scattered. So having this wall there was a lot to it. Now, I'm not trying to convince you like, hey, this is a big deal. This wall needs to happen. The reason it needed to happen, because God put it on Nehemiah's heart. God moved on Nehemiah's heart to such a degree that when he heard about it, he broke down and he wept and he cried out to God. He fasted, he mourned. This mattered because God put it on his heart. So the question I ask you, what has God put on your heart? Has he put anything on your heart? What breaks your heart when you hear about it? Is it the poor? The homeless? I mean, our city's got so many homeless. These rainy days. Has God put that on your heart? And we know poor isn't just homeless. We know a lot more than that. There is countless in our city that are in perpetual poverty. Maybe they have a roof over their head, but every month it's just about making ends meet and getting to the end of the month and just trying to keep food on the table and the bills paid. Those that are in poverty, does that break your heart? What about single moms? So many single moms out there struggling, trying to raise their kids and keep the bills paid and go to work or what, you know, just and trying to live life and trying to make ends meet. Divorce, those in broken relationships. How about those suffering from addiction? Does that break your heart when you hear about those suffering from addiction, that their lives are ruled by this impulse, by this behavior, and what that does, how that cuts off all the relationships? Is it children? We've got all these little innocent children growing up in the city with all this stuff going on. And whether they should be a part of it or not, they are, because it's their city too. And does that break your heart when you think of the kids going up and down these streets? Or the youth? We have our own youth here we were just praying about. And so many different poles, so many different directions, so many different options. And it could break your heart. Did the youth break your heart? What is it for you? What is it for you that breaks your heart? Maybe it's just people far from God. You see people running after their own things, trying to pursue their own pleasure, and they're far from God. And when you know what they need more than anything is to run to God, but yet we see them running far from God. And maybe it's somebody that you love, and maybe it's not anybody that you even know. It's just the people far from God. I don't know. What is it for you that breaks your heart? God doesn't call. There's lots of different things, right? There's so many different problems in our city, problems in our lives, problems in our world, all over the world. Now, God doesn't call all of us to act on all things. I mean, these are all too big. If you should say, oh, all of them, it doesn't work that way, right? God doesn't call us all to all things. But he does put an individual call on an individual's life and say, I want you to give your life to this thing. Maybe it's the mentally ill, helping them with resources and connecting and love and conversation and those sort of things. Whatever that thing is, God puts a call on our life, on an individual's life, to meet an individual need, and he gives us that purpose. That purpose that we've been created for and built for and equipped for, that purpose for us. And often we can find it by asking the question, what breaks your heart? Because that's what God has put on your heart. So as we look to identify what that purpose is, to pursue out that purpose that God has for us, I want to look at Nehemiah in this account, and we're going to look at his life, and there's four things I want us to see that point out some characteristics of God's purpose that were true for Nehemiah, and I think they're also true consistently in how God reveals his purpose, that we're going to see these same characteristics when he's revealing our own purpose. Because I hope that's something you're pursuing is God's purpose for you, because that's the best place for you. It really is. It's the best place for you. Okay, so characteristics of God's purpose. Characteristics. Our first one is this. Characteristics of God's purpose. God's purpose lives on the opposite side of the question, what's in it for me? It lives on the opposite side of that question, what's in it for me? First off, accomplishing God's purpose is what's best for you. It would be the most selfish thing you could do is to live your life to accomplish God's purpose. It's going to be what's best. It's the best thing for you is to give your life to this. But it will not look like it. It's not going to look like the best thing for you, because God's purpose for you lives on the opposite side of the question, what's in it for me? And if you're motivated by that question, what's best for me, if you're motivated by that, you're going to miss God's purpose for you, because it's on the wrong side of that question typically. For Nehemiah, going to King Artaxerxes to ask him to go and rebuild the wall was not what was best for him. What's in it for me? Nothing but grief for Nehemiah when it comes to going to King Artaxerxes to ask to rebuild this wall. First off, it's going to be bad for his career. He's at a pretty high spot. It's going to be bad for his comfort. So here he is. He's pretty high up. He's got the king's ear. He's living in the palace. I'm sure he's got a plush room with nice pillows and silk stuff. He's eating good food because he's eating the king's food. So he's eating the best food in the kingdom. He's got a good life. And now he's asking to give up life in the palace. He's supposed to go give that up, to go travel to this far outpost, to this place that's still kind of rubble, and rebuild a wall. There's not much in it for Nehemiah on that. That's not a good, if you weigh the pros and cons, Those aren't going to add up very good. Not only that, but this is a big ask. He's about ready to make to King Artaxerxes. He's going to go to Artaxerxes and say, I want you to release me from this position. So you got to go find another cupbearer, so you won't have me as in your circle anymore. I want to be released from that. No offense, but I want to be released from that so I can go build this wall. Oh, and by the way, it's going to take tons of resources, tons of money, tons of building supplies, a lot of time. And not just that, what I want to do is build this wall to make Jerusalem more secure. Now, if you've ever run an empire, you know rule number one to keeping your people subjugated is to keep your foot on their neck. And so here he is coming to Artaxerxes and say, hey, you know us Israelites that you rule over, that you've already conquered? I would like to rebuild our wall to make us more secure. I would like to rebuild our fortress and make us more defensible so we can withstand any army that comes against us. Hint, hint. Now, if you're King Artaxerxes, and you've subjugated them, that's the last thing you're going to want to do is let him go build a wall around his city. Because you knocked down that wall that wall's been knocked down for a reason. When the Babylonians came in, they wiped it out so that they could keep their foot on their neck. And here, the Persians are in control, and he's asking them to rebuild the wall. So that's a big ask. So this is something that we know we're going to see in chapter 2 next week that he was nervous about. He was scared about going to the king and asking him to do this. So this was not what was best for Nehemiah according to normal wisdom here, okay? So if he was asking the question, what's in it for me, he would not have followed God toward God's purpose. When God calls us to do something, it's going to look costly. It's going to be costly to accomplish it. Every time God has moved in my heart to do something, it was costly. I'm a pro-cons guy. I do pro-cons lists, like in everything. Every time God moved in my heart to do something, like really step out for his purpose, the con list was always way bigger than the pro list. Every time. That's been a constant in my life. But in hindsight, looking back on those decisions, as hard as they were at the time, I can look back and say, wow, that was the best thing for me. I'm so glad God moved on me to do that thing, even though it didn't look like what was best for me. In hindsight, I can say that. But beforehand, no way. It felt like a death. It felt like mourning every time I had to follow God according to his purpose, because it felt like I was giving up this major thing or making a choice that there wasn't something in it for me, and it's always been difficult. And I worry, though, that a lot of us miss out on the joy that comes with living for God's purpose, of accomplishing God's purpose, of living for that thing that you were created for, the fulfillment that comes with that. I think a lot of us miss out on all that because we're ruled by the question, what's in it for me? And we let that question drive us throughout the day, drive us through life and every decision we make, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? And it's a big step to die to that question and instead follow God's purpose no matter what, even when it doesn't look like there's anything in it for us. Because that question costs us. When we live by that question, we miss out on the joy and the fulfillment of living for God's purpose for us. When Jesus talks about the importance of dying to self, that's what he's talking about. Dying to self. Dying to the question, what's in it for me? And Jesus, he knew it. He lived it. In the garden, he's crying out to God. The night before he goes to the cross, the night before he's arrested and beaten and all that, he's crying out to God, I don't want to do it. It's too costly. There's nothing in it for me. This is not what's best for me. I don't want to do it. Let's go another way. Yet not my will, your will be done. So in the midst of that, he knew that God's purpose lived on the opposite side of the question, what's in it for me? And so, and then he says, so when he tells us, as his disciples, as his followers, that you must pick up your cross and follow me, what do you think he's talking about there? The same experience he had of saying, dying to the question, what's in it for me? And instead, not my will, your will be done. Living for God's purpose instead of what's best for me. What looks to be what's best for me. This is a critical part of the Christian life, is that. Being willing to pick up our cross and follow him. Okay, so that's the first part. discovering God's purpose for us, it lives on the opposite side of that question, what's in it for me? Number two, about God's purpose. Will feel like, accomplishing his purpose, will feel like a moral imperative. A moral imperative. You guys know what that is, a moral imperative? A moral imperative is talking like, there's right and there's wrong, and the moral imperative is what is right. There's no gray in this. There's a right and a wrong, there's a black and a white, and the moral imperative is something that needs to be done. This absolutely has to happen. It's a moral imperative. God has provided moral imperatives for all of us. As followers of his, he decrees that we all must love him with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, right? That is a moral imperative. That we must die to self, we must die to sin, we must pursue the holiness of God. These are all moral imperatives that God has put on each one of us as his followers. All right, these are moral imperatives that are true in our lives. There's a right and a wrong. The moral imperative is what is right. So these are calls that God has put on all of us. These moral imperatives. But there are other things that God will sometimes step in, other things outside of that, and ask an individual to do. He says, hey, you, I want you, specifically you, to do this job. And doing that job is going to feel like a moral imperative. When God calls us to do something, saying yes in that now becomes an act of obedience. When God says, do this thing, it then becomes a moral imperative, an act of right and wrong, whether or not we do that thing. And I'm not talking about sin, like give up that sin. We know we're not supposed, we know that's a moral imperative, but sometimes it'll move us to do something. Quit this job and pursue this other line. How about a simple one? Go talk to that person on the bus. That one, you know who I'm talking about. Go talk to them. And becomes a moral imperative, a right and wrong, whether or not we listen and whether or not we obey. That doing that thing that God has for us becomes an issue of right and wrong. It's not optional. I think a lot of us, we think following God means obeying the rules and then living life as best we can. And when he steps in, hopefully we listen some of the times. No, that's not extra. It's not optional. Obeying God is what it's all about. This is an obedience issue. When God calls us to do something individual, it's about saying yes to him. It's an obedience thing. That's what obedience looks like, being willing to say yes to God. Now, God did not, let me illustrate this. God did not call all of us to go build a wall around Jerusalem. God did not decree that the moral imperative for the world is that Jerusalem needs to have a wall around it, and all of us, we're currently living in sin because we're not on a plane right now to Jerusalem to build a wall. Right? God did not put that call on us. That's not a moral imperative he put for the world. But for Nehemiah, it was a moral imperative. It ruled his life. It dominated his life. It moved him to action because it's something that needed to be done. God put that specific call on his life. Same goes for us. Similar thing. When God gives us his purpose, when he reveals his purpose for us, it's going to feel like a moral imperative that this has to get done. Because it's not just like a good idea. It's not just like, I have to consider. It becomes something that needs to happen. It becomes an issue of obedience. And it's disobedience when we say no in that. Well, Tom, that's not fair. I obey all the commandments. And I don't do those things I'm not supposed to do. Okay, great. Obedience is greater than that. Obedience means saying yes to God. You know what God's favorite quality is? Willingness to say yes. Willingness to say yes to him. All the greats in the Bible, that's what they all got in common. Willingness to say yes to God. So when we're talking about following God and obedience to him, it's not just about abstaining from sin. It's about saying yes to him when he calls us to a specific call. And again, let me point out, when God calls you to something, he's not calling everybody to that thing, and that's okay. So don't be discouraged when God moves you to move on this thing, this issue, this whatever. God put this call on my life to do this thing, to follow this out, to see this to the end. He may not give other people around you the call, everybody, and that's okay. You know, and so you don't get discouraged when not everybody wants to get on board with your issue of, you know, human trafficking is so big in our city. And God's put on people's heart, and maybe he's put on some of your heart too. But if he's put on your heart, don't be all like, oh, these people are all sinners and selfish because they're not joining me in this. You know, God puts different things on all of our hearts, and that's okay. Because God puts a specific call on each one of us of a purpose. And for us to embrace that purpose, to live that purpose out, because that's where the joy and fulfillment comes. And it's going to feel like a moral imperative, like this has to happen because it's an obedience issue. Okay, third, pursuing God's purpose, the characteristic of God's purpose. It's something you've been uniquely prepared for, something you've been uniquely prepared for. That clock just spun like an extra 10 minutes real fast. You guys see that? What happened? It's something you've been uniquely prepared for. Nehemiah was uniquely positioned to accomplish this purpose. Here we have a Jewish dude serving in the house of the Persian king, and he had not only served in his house, but he had his ear. You don't just go walk before the king. As we learned in Esther, if you step before the king without being called before the king, he could just kill you right there. He's tolling his rights, and he did it sometimes. You don't just go to the king like, hey, king, I had this thing on my mind. It's a big deal to go before the king. And yet here's Nehemiah positioned that in his household and in his inner circle and where they could talk casually to be able to bring up this issue of the wall. Not only was he there to have his ear, but he was raised in the household. He was trained up in leadership. He was trained up in administration, all the things he would need to help coordinate this wall. He had influence with the guy who had influence of all these other nations to go get the help that he needed. This was not an accident that Nehemiah was there. God had positioned him there to accomplish this purpose. He had been uniquely prepared for this. Same goes for Esther before him. Same goes for Joseph back in Egypt when there was the famine. And so God placed Joseph right where he was for that specific time. All through the Bible, we see it. Daniel with King Nebuchadnezzar. God put Daniel there for a purpose. He prepared for the purpose for him. Moses with Pharaoh grew up in Pharaoh's household and before it to be the man to then confront Pharaoh about letting his people go. God does this all over the place. He prepares his people for the purpose he has for them well before the purpose comes about. God prepared me for to plant City Lights Church long before I even thought of City Lights Church or Long Beach or anything. In college, God put me in a ministry that began to grow my faith and challenge me in trusting God, and God began to grow my faith in that. Then after college, God moved me from all-white Bellingham, Washington, down to Compton, which was eye-opening in a lot of ways, but it taught me so much about racial reconciliation. It taught me about, give me a heart for the inner city. God had prepared me with that, right? And then he took me from Compton to this church in Gardena, Gardena Valley Baptist Church, and there he taught me what it really meant to be a pastor. I never wanted to be a pastor. Even when I was training to be a pastor, I didn't want to be a pastor. But God used that time to equip me and train me. He had godly men teach me what it looks like to pastor. He sent me to Talbot to learn about Bible study and about God and how to prepare messages and how to just all everything that goes with being a pastor. And then after all that, then he says, hey, Tom, go look at Long Beach. Look at all the need. Look at the diversity. Look for the need for churches. And God then put the purpose on my heart. Then he broke my heart for downtown Long Beach. But he'd been preparing me for that long before. Before I ever knew what was going on, he was doing that for me. So what's he been preparing you for? God's been working in your life, and he's getting you ready for something. What's he been getting you ready for? With your experiences, all right? With your background, with your character, your passions, your personality. He's making you into the perfect tool for something, preparing you. What is it for? I know it's bigger than you. He's got a purpose for you. But as much as he's preparing you for it, and he's getting you ready for it, you're still not going to feel ready. You're not going to feel ready, which is our last one. We're going to close with this. Our final one is this. You won't feel ready because the fourth thing about characteristic of God's purpose, it will drive you to complete dependence on God. It will drive you to complete dependence on God. When he approaches you with his purpose for you, your response will not be, awesome, I got this. I'm so ready. I'm going to nail this one. I'm going to hit it out of the park. Instead, you're going to say, I can't do that. Are you crazy? There's no way. And it's going to drive you to God. It's going to drive you to dependence on God because you can't do it by your own power. It's going to drive you to dependence on God, which is exactly where he wants you. When Nehemiah heard about the wall, he didn't say, oh, I got this, no problem. Let's go build that wall. Instead, verse 4, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. It drove him to dependence on God. In that prayer, we see that in that dependence on God, when he prayed, we see that first off, he repented of his sins. In verse 6 and 7, he says, hey, we've been disobedient. Me too. I'm the worst. He repented of his sins. He recommitted to God. He said, remember how you said that when we come back to you, that you'll receive us back? Here I am. I'm back. I recommit to you. Here I am, your servant. So he recommitted to God. And then third, he totally trusted in him. He depended on him. He prayed that give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. He knew that he couldn't convince Artaxerxes that God would have to do the work. He was dependent on God. So in 2016, we're in closing, and not just 2016, but in life, beginning with now, let's dedicate our lives to pursuing God's purpose, discovering what his plan for us is, his purpose for us is, and living that out. Don't let our unwillingness to repent or recommit get in the way of that, because it will. It'll rob you of your joy. It'll rob you of the peace that comes in living in God's perfect plan. And let's give our lives to that. So in closing encouragement, make 2016 count by dedicating it to pursuing God's purpose for you. Let's pray. God, I am so thankful that we don't just have got to wander through life going experience by experience, but instead you are orchestrating things. I'm thankful for your perfect plan. God, help us to live in light of that plan. God, I pray that for all of us, you'd be showing us, revealing to us your plan for us, your purpose for us. God, break our heart for what you want to see done. Move us to action. And God, I pray for all of us, we'd be able to see that clearly and respond to it. Even when it doesn't look like what's best for us, even when we don't feel equipped, even when we don't feel ready, we would do it. We would say yes to you. God, I can't wait to see what happens at City Lights Church with the church that you use in mighty ways, full of people you use in mighty ways. In Jesus' name, amen.